I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It's been another busy and contentious week in politics. Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., took on Larry Kudlow, the president's new head of the National Economic Council, when he mansplained that she was confused when she talked about new Russia sanctions on a Sunday talk show. She shot back, "With all due respect, I don't get confused." Fired FBI Director James Comey has been interviewed by just about every news outlet this week about his new book, A Higher Loyalty. And last night, his memos, about his conversations with President Trump were released. Trump tweeted, "James Comey memos just out show clearly there was no collusion and no obstruction." Trump has hired three new lawyers as the Mueller investigation continues. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's spending habits are under fire, with more Republicans raising concerns about the controversy. Mike Pompeo has a tough fight in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee over his nomination for Secretary of State. Former First Lady Barbara Bush died earlier this week. She was 92 years old, the wife and mother of two presidents, 41 and 43. The funeral is tomorrow. And in a first, Senator Tammy Duckworth's two-week-old baby girl was permitted on the Senate floor yesterday so her mom could vote. She apparently wore a blazer, the required Senate dress code. Well, joining us, we have three guests to talk about all of this and more. That was a long introduction there. Joe Watkins with us here in our Philadelphia studio, former White House aide for Bush 1. He's a political commentator. He's been a regular contributor for MSNBC. Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And down there in Washington, D.C. at the NPR studios, we have Mickey Edwards, was a Republican congressman from Oklahoma for 16 years, from 73 to 93. And Mickey Edwards, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. Glad to be back with
you. Nice to have you back. And also with us and joining us by telephone is Sam Stein. He's politics editor at the Daily Beast, also an MSNBC contributor. Sam, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, I was tempted to call this the Hooker's Porn Star Playboy Mansion edition of Radio Times after the president tweeted about Stormy Daniels' sketch of the man that she says threatened her. Sam, is it possible to separate all these things that are going on between the sex and the politics?
At this point, I don't think so. They're all so intertwined, mostly through legal channels. You do sometimes wake up and have to wonder how we got to this point. I was wondering this morning, just stepping back, we now know that Donald Trump, as he assumed the presidency, all these global problems at his feet, incredible responsibilities. And according to these memos outlined by former FBI Director James Comey, his mind seemed almost preoccupied with the idea that he was accused of being with hookers in Russia. And you know, sometimes these things get lost, but that's an incredible thing to consider, that a new president, highly inexperienced already, was so distracted by these allegations just weeks into assuming office.
Mickey Edwards, as a member of Congress, what do you make of this point that we're in?
Well, you know, one of the things first I have to say, you know, about the president is the first thing he said when he became president of the United States was how big the crowd was. And so this is somebody who looks at everything, whether it's an international crisis or the perhaps members of his own administration having talked too many times to the Russians. He looks at it all in personal terms. He doesn't really think in terms of the nation and the big issues before him. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he would meet with Comey and that he would start out by thinking about what's in this dossier and whether or not he was accused of being with prostitutes.
Do you see him as a Republican, Mickey Edwards?
I don't see him as anything. He's certainly not a Republican. He never was a Republican. The positions he has taken are not Republican positions. But, Marty, the bad part about it is, do Republicans see him as a Republican? Republican members of Congress, and they see him as their captain. They see him as the head of their team, and therefore they're too willing to go along with him just because they might get a tax bill they like in exchange. And so they're accepting him. They're adopting him as a Republican.
Joe, how do you see this moment? And then I want to get to some very specific things, but it seems like a collision of so many things going on.
Well, clearly it is a collision of a lot of different things going on. On the one hand,
Americans like to admire the person who is their president. Usually, that doesn't always happen. I mean, there'll always be partisan politics where people take one side or the other, and they find reason to not like whoever is in the lead if they're not of their party. But at the same time, we generally like to admire, and it's certainly even after the fact, we like to admire the person that led us, and we'd like to find qualities in them that we find admirable. And this is just a very difficult time from that standpoint.
To find admirable qualities.
That's not to say that he hasn't had some success in terms of getting a tax bill passed and some other things. But at the end of the day, I think many Americans don't admire the character of the president. He's a smart man. He's been able to win the presidency. He was able to win it convincingly over 16 very polished politicians. So from that standpoint, he's a smart enough individual to know how to do that. But from the standpoint of uniting us and of leading us to the better natures of our, the better angels of our nature, we don't see that happening right now.
Sam, let me go back to you, and we could spend the whole hour on the memos that were released. Obviously, they were leaked last night. I had a chance to look at some of them, and it seems that depending on which side of the president you're on, you can take something from these memos. What do you see? What are we learning, I guess, from these Comey memos?
Well, I think first and foremost, the memos confirm, or at least show, that Comey was accurate in what has been his retelling of those situations, both before a congressional committee and now in his book. I mean, the memos back up a lot of his assertions. If anything, they paint a picture that is even more bizarre and dire than Comey was illuminating when he was talking about them. And to reiterate my first point, what I was struck by was the degree both to which Trump was obsessed with this possibility that he could have been found with hookers in Russia, and then also the degree to which he and his staff really were sort of ill-prepared for the job. I mean, there was one memo in particular that struck me where then-Chief of Staff Reince Priebus goes up to Comey and basically doesn't even know if Comey has a law degree, which anyone who had known Comey knew he was at the Southern District of New York, but also really didn't understand the proper channels of communication for very sensitive information, such as is the National Security Advisor under a FISA warrant. And I think that struck Comey, too, which was this is essentially an amateur hour, this operation. So those were my main takeaways from the memos.
Have you looked at them, Mickey Edwards?
Well, just cursorily, but what I was taken by is the fact that Trump seemed to have no real understanding of what his limits were, what he could and could not say to the head of the FBI, what he thought an FBI director owed to him as opposed to owed to the country. And, you know, so, and I think Comey has been saying that all along, and I think the memos, you know, make clear that this is what he saw and that he was disturbed by it.
Do you think Comey did enough to push back on the president when the president wanted him, you know, alone in the White House? Clearly, Comey was uncomfortable, Mickey Edwards, but he did do it.
Yeah, Comey did his best, I think, to show proper deference to the president. And even now in his interviews, he is making clear he doesn't hate the president and so forth. You know, so I think he was caught a little unawares. I mean, when suddenly you're told, I'm going to excuse all these other people, ask them to leave the office so that I can talk to you alone, that raises red flags. And if you're Comey, you don't know what to do. This is the president asking to meet with you alone, and it's an awkward situation.
You're nodding your head, Joe Watkins.
It's very awkward, of course, but it kind of underscores a point that I've made in the past. I agree with Sam and Mickey on a whole host of points. I think the president is not an ideologue. He's not somebody who has any kind of a real politically ideological bent. But he's a transactional person, and this kind of underscores it. His behavior with Comey underscores the fact that he's about transactions and succeeding in the transaction of the moment. And he doesn't always do his homework. So clearly, and the chain of command doesn't operate in this White House the way it has in other White Houses. By the time things get to the president is usually well briefed because the staff has given the president every bit of information he or someday she will need to know about the person or persons with whom they'll be meeting. And clearly that's not happening now. Reince Priebus should have known all about Comey, and clearly Comey should have been briefed as well, as the president should have been briefed in advance of the meeting. These should not be off-the-cuff meetings with things unfolding as they might.
Well, let me segue to that. And actually, Mickey, if I can go back to you, the president talked about his upcoming meeting with the head of North Korea, basically saying, look, if it's not a good deal, I'm going to walk away. Is that how this is supposed to work?
Well, first of all, there should be a lot more preparation than there has been. It was interesting to see that Pompeo had been over there, and so they're doing some kind of prep work. But I think the president really needs to say, if I'm going to sit down with a head of state, even if it's somebody like the head of North Korea, you have to be prepared to go in there knowing what you want, what you can expect to hear from the other side, and conduct a serious negotiation. It's not like you're sitting down with an employee, and you're going to end the meeting, just because I don't like where it's going. I mean, that's not the way you deal with the head of another government.
Is this a high-risk meeting, Sam Stein?
To say the least.
I was going to say
We're talking about nuclear nonproliferation. We're talking about, incredible geopolitical ripple effects, not just throughout the Korean Peninsula, but, all of Asia, U.S.-China relations, so on and so forth. And, I'm not going to say, obviously, if people want this deal to happen for a variety of reasons. I mean, the potential outcome is demonstrably good. But I think it's objectively true that heading into this, the U.S., is in a very sort of ill-prepared posture. I mean, no doubt Trump has very limited familiarity with nuclear nonproliferation. I think his entire prism is the Iran nuclear deal. But also, we don't have key officials and ambassadors in those critical positions to help with the pre-talks, which is, as anyone who followed the Iran nuclear deal would know, the pre-talks are in many ways more important than when the actual top officials get in a room together. So I am sort of very, 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 very cautiously looking at this, hoping for the best, but preparing for the fact that this might not even happen, this type of meeting.
Well, let's take a very short break. We have much more to talk about. That's Sam Stein, politics editor for The Daily Beast. He's a contributor to MSNBC, as is our guest, Joe Watkins, who's here with us in our Philadelphia studio. He's a political commentator for MSNBC. He did work in the first Bush White House, and he's got a new essay called The New PC, Practical Consideration. Mickey Edwards, a Republican congressman from Oklahoma, served 16 years in the House of Representatives, from 77 to 93. Much more to talk about after this very short break. In fact, I'll play a clip from President Trump speaking at Mar-a-Lago on Wednesday about Russia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Another dizzying week in politics here in America. You can join our conversation, 1-888 after 31 years, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me play a clip from earlier this week. This is President Trump speaking at Mar-a-Lago on Wednesday. It was a joint press conference with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe answering a question about Russia sanctions.
There has been nobody tougher on Russia than President Donald Trump. Between building up the military, between creating tremendous vast amounts of oil, we raised billions and billions of dollars extra in NATO. We had a very, very severe, we were talking about it a little while, fight in Syria recently, a month ago, between our troops and Russian troops. And that's very sad. But many people died in that fight. There has been nobody tougher than me. With the media, no matter what I did, it's never tough enough because that's their narrative. But Russia will tell you there has been nobody tougher than Donald Trump.
Mickey Edwards, what would you say back to the president?
Well, I would say, for one thing, that you sound like a sixth grader, you know, carrying on about how you're tougher than the other kid in your class. You know, the fact is that, number one, he hasn't created a whole lot of new energy. I mean, he makes stuff up as he goes. And one of the things that he hasn't done is be very tough with Russia about the intrusions into our elections, which is something he has remained silent about ever since he was elected. So he sees apparently some need to make it look like he's not in Putin's pocket, but it's really not very persuasive.
You're saying he's in Putin's pocket?
I am saying that he goes out of his way to avoid direct condemnation of some of the things that we know that the Russians have done to help undermine our democracy, that any president of the United States should be very concerned about, and he just won't say anything about it.
Sam, I began the introduction with Nikki Haley pushing back on Kudlow, saying,
yep,
I don't get confused. I thought that was really an interesting moment. But she's tough on, or certainly tougher than the president on Russia. Does she get her marching orders from the White House, or is she freelancing?
That's probably one of the tougher questions to answer. It certainly seems like she was freelancing in this moment, in that she went out there perhaps with some direction or some inclination of where the administration was heading. And very quickly, her position was undermined by her superiors, in this case, President Trump. And it gets to exactly what the congressman was saying, which is that there is a propensity for this president to side with Putin, to be obsequious towards Putin, to pursue policies that are not beneficial, I wouldn't go that far, but soft on Russia compared to what could have been. And that is true also in the Comey memos, to try to tie all these bows together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more interesting memos comes where Trump is doing his inaugural calls to world leaders. He's just been inaugurated. He has a list of people he needs to talk to on the phone. And the first call he takes is with Theresa May. And he gets incredibly angry at Michael Flynn for not telling him that a separate world leader had called him, and for not telling him for a number of days that world leader had called him. Now, the name of that world leader is redacted, but it's pretty easy to put the pieces together here. It was Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. And Trump was incredibly angry with his national security advisor for not telling him for 6 days that Putin had called. And he was angry precisely because he thought it would be offensive to Putin. That is a real great window into the mindset of the president at that moment, knowing that Russia was being accused of meddling in the election, knowing that there was an FBI investigation into the meddling. His mindset is on, geez, did I offend Putin personally? And so, we have this common thread line through from inauguration to Nikki Haley's speech before the United Nations.
You want to add to that, Joe? And then I do want to play Mitch McConnell talking with Neil Cavuto about whether there should be legislation to protect Special Counsel Mueller. But anything you want to – it is so confounding to look at what the Russians apparently did in the election, and to look at the President of the United States and what he either does or doesn't say.
Yeah, well, from the standpoint of Nikki Haley, it's tough to be staff in this day and age. And that's even if you're a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, you're staff. And at the end of the day, staff has to take orders from the top. And sometimes the messages are not clear. I think the president wants to have it both ways. On the one hand, he wants to be able to say that he's been tough on Russia. And I think both Sam and Mickey have hit the nail on the head with regards to the reality of that. And then, on the other hand, he would like to be a friend to Vladimir Putin. And so, therefore, he's very, very careful about doing anything that might be offensive to Vladimir Putin. And that's clear and obvious.
I think the question is why. I mean, we don't – that's what Mueller is looking
into. That's what Mueller is looking into. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump has been very successful for many, many years as a marketing person. And from what I mean by that is that he realizes that if you say it – long enough that, that some portion of the people will believe it. And so if you say I have the biggest buildings or I have the best this or the best that, there will be some notion, some number of people that believe it. And he's also been very successful in creating, at least from the standpoint of his base, an us against them mentality. So from the standpoint of the base, even decent, thoughtful criticism is muted by this us against them mentality, which says that, well, they're against us, so therefore whatever they say is not relevant.
Let me play this clip. And again, this is Senate Majority Leader speaking with Fox News' Neil Cavuto. This was on Tuesday about a legislation to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller.
There's a move afoot among some of your colleagues just to make sure the president doesn't get rid of Mueller, to institutionally shield Mueller from being fired. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's not necessary. There's no indication that Mueller's going to be fired. I don't think the president's going to do that. And just as a practical matter, even if we passed it, why would he sign it?
So you don't think it's a good idea? No, and you don't think it's something the president would entertain or should entertain?
Well, I don't think he should fire Mueller, and I don't think he's going to. So this is a piece of legislation that's not necessary in my judgment.
Well, obviously, a number of your colleagues fear it enough to say it should be in there as an insurance.
Yeah, but I'm the one who decides what we take to the floor. That's right. My responsibility as the majority leader, and we'll not be having this on the floor of the Senate.
He's the decider, Mickey Edwards. What do you make of that? Fact that there are, it seems like there are more Republicans who are signing on to this idea of some kind of a bill to protect Mueller.
I think we need to find out whether or not there's a secret agreement between Schumer and McConnell, and whether or not McConnell is trying to help the Democrats. Because he has been, you know, whether you go back to Supreme Court nominees or this, he constantly makes decisions that if I were a member of the Senate, I would be trying to, you know, vote him out and get a new majority leader. There is clearly room for and a need for, in my opinion, a bipartisan agreement, you know, standing up to protect Mueller. And the fact that he is reluctant to bring that to the floor is really inexplicable so far as I'm concerned. I mean, they're not saying that the president needs to be protected against everything. Say, you know, protect the investigation. Mm-hmm. Let the investigation go forward. Make sure that Mueller is not fired. And why he won't do that, I just can't understand.
Sam, is there a workaround around Mitch McConnell?
No. He is right in one respect. He is the decider of what comes to the floor. And even if there were 80 votes in the Senate for this bill, if Mitch McConnell doesn't want to bring it to the floor, it's not coming to the floor. The fact of the matter is there are pretty obvious indications that Trump has entertained the idea of firing Bob Mueller. It's been reported on several times that he's asked his aides, including White House counsel Don McGahn, to go about doing it. The White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, has said from the podium that they believe they have the authority to do so. Now, why would she say that they believe they have the authority to do so unless they had checked it out? And why would they have checked it out unless they had entertained the idea? So it's silly to say that there is no need for this legislation. There's quite a need for this legislation. That being said, Mitch McConnell is right on one ground. Trump would veto the thing.
Right.
At that point, you would need 67 votes. And from our reporting, there are not 67 votes in the Senate for this.
Why hasn't he done it, Sam? I mean, if he can, he's entitled. He has the power to do it. Why do you think he has not?
Why Trump hasn't done it?
Yes.
It's precisely because there are enough people in his ear who tell him that it would facilitate the end of his presidency as he knew it, that it would cause social chaos. There was a very little notice but highly telling news story out of Pittsburgh this past week where the local police department had sent around an internal memo telling people or instructing their officers what to do should rioting happen in the wake of Bob Mueller being fired. Wow. I mean, that's where we're at right now, you know. So I think Donald Trump may be reckless. He may be careless. He may not have any appreciation for the norms. But I also think he understands that the extent of the chaos that would ensue should he do this. I also think that there's enough people who've told him that firing James Comey was the biggest mistake of his presidency. Mm. And he might not want to touch that hot stove again.
This is an email that's been sitting on my screen here for a number of minutes here. Sorry, Mickey or Joe, whoever said Trump isn't a Republican, he is. The proof is the people in his cabinet. Pruitt, DeVos, Zinke, as Republican as it gets, deregulate anything and everything to increase profit. Mickey Edwards, you served in the House as a Republican. I don't know. Are you? I know you're a... Can I say never Trumper? I know you are.
Absolutely, I'm a never Trumper.
Okay, fair.
Absolutely. I mean, I cannot imagine that the American people elected a person of this character to be the president.
Are you still a Republican?
Well, yeah, I'm a Republican who is really pretty disgusted with the behavior of a lot of the Republicans in Congress these days. I think that, you know, I still think, you know, lower taxes are a good thing. I think less regulation is a good thing. Stronger military is a good thing. But the price that members of Congress today are willing to pay in terms of their own morality and their own character in order to get those policy outcomes is something I just can't go along with.
Well, Joe, when you look at the polling among Republicans, there still is majority support for President Trump.
Yeah, so there's a disconnect between the polling numbers and the way a lot of people feel. But at the end of the day, I share the same sadness that many other Americans share with regards to our elected officials, which is, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, do the right thing. Just do the right thing by people and be about public interest, about the best interests of the public and not self-interest. And so much of what we see happening today is about self-interest. People are trying to perpetuate their own careers. They're acting in their own best self-interest. They're protecting themselves, their own self-interests. And they're not acting in the best interest of the public. And I would rather see people just have the guts to stand up and just say what's right and what's true and then take their lumps.
You know, Mickey, you wrote, I don't need to tell you, but this I'll tell this to our listeners, 2011, a cover story in The Atlantic, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. A year later, you wrote The Parties Versus the People. Is this a party problem?
Well, it's a party problem in a lot of ways. I think the political system, you know, George Washington and James Madison, you know, don't create political parties. And instead, we did, and we're paying a price because the separation of powers is being undermined by party loyalty. The normal operations of the House and Senate are undermined by party loyalty. I think that there is too much of, you know, how do we protect our team instead of what is in the interest of Americans, and how can we work together to solve our common problems?
But what we hear, Mickey, is that not all, but a number of Republicans privately complain about the president but publicly defend him.
Well, why would they do that? I mean, there are a lot of Republicans who are apparently, and maybe some Democrats too, who live in terror of losing. So, great. You know, I lost my election. I went on to teach at Harvard and Princeton. I've got a great job now. I've written some books. I mean, life doesn't end if you leave Congress. So do what's right. Just what was just said. You know, do what's right. You know, live up to your moral responsibilities and the oath of office you took when you came into Congress. And if you lose, you lose.
Let me play House Speaker Paul Ryan. He is resigning at the end of the year, or certainly he's not running for re-election. And here he is talking to Chuck Todd on MSNBC, or I guess on NBC, on Meet the Press. This was last Sunday, and this was about his announcement that he will not seek re-election.
When you called President Trump, what did he say?
He was disappointed, but he understood. He understood. You know,
You tried to talk you out of it?
He was disappointed. We have a good relationship. We've gotten a lot done together. And, you know, I basically explained to him my whole family dynamic. And it's the thing is, I feel content because I've actually gotten a lot done, and I've gotten much of what I came here to do done. Not everything, but much of what I wanted to do. And, you know, I feel like I've accomplished great things, and my kids aren't getting any younger. And I kind of just walked him through my thinking, and he said, well, I can't argue with that.
Sam, not the first Speaker of the House to leave after a couple of years. What do you make of this?
I can't speak to his family dynamic, and it's perfectly reasonable, understandable, even laudable if he is in fact leaving because he wants to spend time with his kids who are teenagers and who he only sees on the weekends and abbreviated weekends at that. Where I quibble, I suppose, is in the idea that he and Donald Trump are simpatico ideologically have gotten a lot done and are close friends. You talk to anyone on the Hill, and there's an immense amount of private frustration and even horror at how this president has conducted himself in office. And that's among Republicans, too. Of course, when you put a camera on them or a microphone in their face, then everything is different. And I think Paul Ryan, to a certain degree, has those frustrations in private, but he's been somewhat of an enabler in public. And, you know, his legacy as Speaker is going to be a little bit difficult to define because of how he has approached the Trump presidency. He has been notably critical at times, but during the most important junctures, he's helped normalize Trump in a way that I think some Paul Ryan mm-hmm. fans have found unfortunate.
Joe, with the tax bill that was signed by the president, yes, it does lower taxes, although I think rich people make out a lot better than the rest of the population. But it balloons the debt, and that seems so un-Paul Ryan.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I think it's there are some things about it that he can claim are a victory as a Republican. I think the sad reality becomes is that there was no bipartisan. There was nothing bipartisan about it. There was no Democratic input. And clearly, from the standpoint of the deficit hawks, this legislation did nothing to further the point that they have made time and again about the need to reduce the deficit. But that being said, I would wish that Paul Ryan would just feel enabled to be free to speak his mind and not live in fear of ruffling. Political his fellow politicians just
knowing he doesn't have to run for re-election.
Absolutely, just tell the truth. I mean, it's a good thing that he's leaving office to spend more time with his kids, because you can't sacrifice your kids. You know, your kids do need you, and they need you there. At the same time, talk honestly about the challenges that you face, so the country can get better, and so the president can do a better job of being president. Maybe that criticism will help him move in the right direction.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about this week's news, the state of American politics. Sam Stein, politics editor at The Daily Beast. He's a contributor to MSNBC, as is our other guest, Joe Watkins, here with us in our Philadelphia studios. He's a political commentator and, again, a regular contributor to MSNBC. And he did work in the first Bush White House. Mickey Edwards was a Republican congressman from Oklahoma from 77 to 93 for 16 years. He served on the House Budget and Appropriations Committee, also chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee. And Mickey, an email from Mike from Wilmington says, he says in his email, P.S., I worship at the temple of Mickey Edwards, just so you know. Not sure what that's about. That's Mike.
Well, I hope my wife is listening.
That's Mike from Wilmington giving you a shout out there. Let me talk, I do want to talk about Barbara Bush, who died earlier this week. She was 92 years old. And this is Barbara Bush at the 1992 GOP convention. She's speaking on PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff about her husband's lagging poll numbers. This is, of course, during the 92 campaign.
What's the matter with Americans? You are in the best shape of any country in the world. Don't Americans know that when you achieve peace, it costs money? Peace is costly. We ought to be willing to pay for the fact that we go to bed every single night of our life freer and safer because of George Bush. Things are turning, Judy, and they're coming to a strong economy. But we're going to have to all work for it. But it's because we have peace, and we ought to be darn grateful to George Bush.
And, of course, he did not win re-election. You know the Bush family. Joe Watkins.
Yes, I had the pleasure to work in the White House for the first President Bush. My wife worked in the administration as well. for the first President Bush and had a number of great experiences. And our daughter worked in the White House for George W. Bush. And my wife was appointed by George W. Bush to be the regional administrator of the small
BFF,
business.
BFF, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've had a lot of interaction with the family. But I had a lot of personal interaction with Mrs. Bush and just had the utmost respect and love for her. Smart woman, sharp, witty, fiercely loyal, as you could tell from that piece that you just played from PBS. And not somebody whose wrong side you want to be on. I mean, they did call her the enforcer, and for good reason. She would set you straight in a minute, in a New York minute, or in a Texas minute, for that matter. But I remember the first time that I was walking into the Oval Office, actually the area right outside the Oval Office. I was talking to Patty Priesock, the president's executive assistant, and Tim McBride, who was his special assistant. And Mrs. Bush came out of the Oval Office with Anna Perez, her press secretary, and she looked at me and kind of did a double take and said, "Hey, young man, Joe Watkins." And I said, "Oh, my gosh, you know, she knows me." And she said, "I've heard a lot about you." I said, "Oh, what have you heard about me?" And she said, "Oh, well, you're a lot older than you look because you've got teenage daughters. You know, I know you have a little boy, but you've got teenage daughters." I said, "Well, that's true, Mrs. Bush." And she laughed and was very, very nice. And that was my first interaction with her. But she and the president invited us to celebrate their 45th wedding anniversary to watch a movie in the White House. Mm-hmm. And I would always tell the celebrities that I brought in, like Michael Jackson and Whitney Houston, that if you want to see the family living quarters, you got to see Mrs. Bush. She's the one that invites you upstairs.
Entree.
She was the entree.
Mickey, do you have a Barbara Bush story?
Well, it's a little different one. I didn't know her as well as Joe did, but and I knew the president pretty well. But one time I was lucky enough to be invited to a White House dinner and was seated at the number two table with Barbara Bush, you know, the president at one table and first lady at the second. And some people had come over and I was standing up talking to them and Barbara Bush said, "Mickey, sit down." So exactly
yes,
what
ma'am.
Joe said. Yes, this is her.
Right.
Whoops, I'm not sure where that is coming from. Oh, we will figure that out. We all of a sudden have music. Diane, if you can just pull that down. Okay. Do we still have you there, Mickey? All right. No, we don't. We're going to try to reconnect with Mickey Edwards. I'm not sure where that music came from. Sam Stein, the funeral for Barbara Bush is tomorrow. I saw this morning that the president will not be there. And I think the description was it would just be too disruptive. What do you make of that?
Well, first off, if you want to put the music back up, it's very pleasant.
secondly, little interlude.
You know, I think it's probably for the best. The Bush family and the Trump family are not on the best of terms. Let's just put it that way. Barbara Bush was highly critical of Donald Trump, especially for how he treated Megyn Kelly during the campaign, but also for, of course, how he was so patronizing and cruel to her son, Jeb, during the campaign. And so for Trump to show up now would be really, you know, sort of alcohol on the wound, so to speak. Trump's also, you know, doesn't seem like the type of person who wants to be in these types of situations. These are reflective, emotional. They're sort of the types of moments where you try to call to your better spirit, and that's not really his forte at all. And so as of now, the president will still be in Mar-a-Lago, as he's been all week, and the funeral will go on without him.
Let me give out that phone number again. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We're hoping to hook up with Mickey Edwards. That explained the music. He got dumped by some music, and we're going to get him back on the air, and we will continue our conversation. Let me read let me get back to some more questions here. To you, Sam Stein, where is the Mueller investigation? Where does it stand now?
That's a really great question. And the truth of the matter is no one really knows except for the people on Mueller's team. There's been these reoccurring hopes among Trump's legal team that it will wind up at some point in the near future, there was talk of it being over by Thanksgiving and then Christmas and then by the end of the year and then within February. And now Rudy Giuliani has been brought on board and he is discussing coming to some sort of agreement to end the thing in a matter of weeks. I just don't know what an agreement
would
actually look like.
How would he do that?
There's nothing he can... I don't know. I don't think anyone who's studied these things or been involved in high-level criminal investigations understands what he means by negotiating a settlement. The truth is that Mueller is constantly, at least it seems from the outside, coming upon new material. And the raid of Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer, the raid of Michael Cohen's house could have the potential for elongating this investigation even more weeks or months. So, you know, to give the listener an answer, I'd have to say no one actually knows what the status is of this investigation. We know what charges they've brought. We know that they've indicted 13 Russian actors for meddling in the election. We know that they've gotten guilty pleas from, among others, Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos and Rick Gates. We know that they're bringing charges against Manafort. So that gives us a broad picture of the stuff that they've covered already. But that could just be the tip of the iceberg.
Mickey, we have you back, yes?
We do, yes.
Okay, that's great. What would you, how do I put this? Things are coming at us from all different directions here.
Yes.
What do you want to know? If you could talk to Robert Mueller, what would you want to know that they are looking at? And as Sam said, it's a pretty tight ship.
Well, I think it's interesting to find out the things about what Michael Cohen was doing, and it's interesting to find out about what Manafort was doing. But, you know, the thing that I think we really want to focus on, I mean, these are collateral, but I'd like to know the extent to which the Russians were interfering and upsetting our election process, and to what extent, if any, members of the Trump team during the campaign were involved in that. I think that's the primary thing. So some, you know, if you get Paul Manafort for some of his dealings, or you get Michael Cohen for some of the underhanded things that the fixer apparently does, I think that's great. We need to know about it, but I don't want to lose track of what this is all about, which is whether or not the president and his campaign team were involved in helping the Russians, you know, mess with an American election, because that's pretty serious.
Let me read an email, and then Joe, we'll hear from you. Is it possible that Trump is playing the long game in regards to, slipped away there, in regards to Putin? Are there any laws that would prohibit Trump from taking advantage of his connections with Putin and Russia after he leaves office? I mean, that's getting a bit ahead of the story. But what do you want to know what's going on?
I want to know... I want to just know what happens. It happened in the most unprejudiced way. I think Eric Holder gave a very good interview the other night on MSNBC as the former Attorney General of the United States, talking about what happens in these kinds of investigations that Robert Mueller is proceeding it actually pretty quickly. He's making what Eric Holder called a very good progress in terms of uncovering the facts and in being able to eventually call witnesses and in some cases flip people. So I think that Robert Mueller is the intelligent, thoughtful person that many of us thought that he was, that he's gathering all the necessary information, that he's not getting ahead of himself. He's not allowing politics to sway his investigation to move it any faster or any slower than it would normally proceed. And that ultimately, as he is able to flip people and likewise make public what he knows, we'll all know it. And so he's moving with all deliberate speed, and it's moving probably at the right speed.
Sam, let me ask you about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, his spending habits certainly under fire. I think there's something like half a dozen investigations looking into bulletproof desk. I didn't even know such a thing existed, but other spending as well. He has the president's support so far. It seems he of maybe all the members of the cabinet is following through on what the president promised when he was running for office. What do you see as the future of Scott Pruitt?
This is such a weird story in so many regards. You are absolutely right. He is under fire on multiple fronts. The spending habits, the first class flights, the staffing raises that he gave that went behind the back of the White House to do that, the fact that he stayed in a home of a prominent lobbyist who had business before the EPA at the time that he was staying. I mean, we could go through this. And, you know, any other White House, any other time, he would have been gone after any one of these, but he is still in his position. The question is why. You know, the conventional wisdom is that he's there because he's executing the president's deregulatory agenda, and that is true. He's mm-hmm. doing it. I guess I have a tough time figuring out why anyone who would be in that position couldn't do this stuff. It's not like he's relying on Congress to do this. He's writing rules vis-a-vis the EPA that essentially allow them to do it as an agency. Anyone with a legal degree could probably get the same thing done. So what is it about Scott Pruitt that the president is saying, I need to have this guy still around? And one of the few explanations that we've stumbled upon is that Scott Pruitt is really connected within Republican legal circles. He's really connected among Republican donor types. He has a big fan base in those crowds, and those crowds are influential, not just among the president, but among the president's staff. And so he's holding on, whereas someone like a David Shulkin, who previously ran the Veterans Organization, was gone for objectively far less of scandal.
Let me read a tweet from Christopher. The politicization of politics is not equal on both sides. The Democrats have never attacked federal judges or the FBI. Our level of discourse has never sunk anywhere close to the level of Trump's Twitter feed. Do you agree, Mickey Edwards?
Well, I certainly agree that we've never had a president before who had the same kind of distorted character that Donald Trump has. So I think that's true. I think Democrats have historically been very good at partisanship, and they have been very good at cutting off opportunities for Republicans to participate. They did it when I was there. So they're not pure either. But sure, I mean, there's never been a Democratic president or another Republican president who was like Donald Trump. Thank goodness.
Mickey, let me try out a theory on you, and you can shoot it down, that
okay.
Sarah Palin led us to Donald Trump. The idea that John McCain picked Sarah Palin to be his vice president opened the door to someone like Donald Trump.
Well, that's not altogether, you know, a nonsense theory, you know, Marty. I mean, part of it is, you know, that it set us up where we became accustomed to having somebody running for the highest offices who was untethered a bit from the truth, who was all about how insulting and how much raw meat she could throw out to the audiences. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Her behavior was a little bit of a precursor. Can I add one thing back
sure.
to Scott Pruitt?
Sure.
I think people forget that before he became EPA administrator, Pruitt was an attorney general who was one of the real leaders in terms of the hard right positions on a number of issues as AG. And I think that built him a great reservoir of support on the right, separate from what he's doing in this administration.
And wasn't that Oklahoma, your state?
It was, absolutely.
Did you know him, or do you know him?
No, I don't know him, but I know that a lot of people who I admire back home do have a good opinion of him. I don't have a particularly good opinion of him, but I know that he's popular with a lot of people in Oklahoma still.
Well, we could go on, but we do have to end our conversation. Mickey Edwards, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Joe Watkins, thank you as always for coming in
Great
and joining us on
thanks.
Radio Times as well. And Sam Stein, appreciate you being part of the conversation as well.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And we appreciate all the calls and comments to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and John Ahrens with help from Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.